when a thief came up to this house in the middle of the night, it seemed he was after one thing, but he had no idea there was one security camera catching his every move.
Tom DiRico captured this frightening house call on his doorbell security camera.
A burglar who waved at a home security camera before trying to break into a car. Deputies say they arrested the teen and that he is behind many more crimes.
It was because of this video from a Ring doorbell that helped police locate and identify 17-year-old Dominic Rodriguez.
Four teens arrested for a violent carjacking at a park. Surveillance video helped lead to their capture.
Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To The Point, and we're talking today about the tension between privacy and freedom created by surveillance technology. There are cameras all over the place right now. Whose cameras are they, and what happens to the images that they record, and what is the relevance of software designed for facial recognition? A lot of people are very concerned about this. One of them is Cade Crockford. She is director of the ACLU of Massachusetts Technology for Liberty Project. Cade Crockford, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about your concerns. What are they when it comes to surveillance technology, and what do you think needs to be done?
Well, for the past 20 or so years, largely with the help of the federal government through grants bestowed upon local communities by the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice, we've seen the expansion and the creation and expansion of CCTV networks, surveillance camera networks throughout our even smaller cities and towns across the United States. And for years, these camera systems have documented ordinary people living their lives. But there's plenty of research to show that surveillance cameras themselves don't really give law enforcement all that much information about our daily activities, even if they're blanketing a community, like, for example, in London. And the main reason for that is that human beings can't actually watch all of those camera streams and keep track of where every person is going and what they're doing and who they're walking with. And so the cameras are really mostly useful for law enforcement when something happens, right? There's a car accident, there's a murder, there's a rape, and potentially some of it's captured on camera. Police can go and look at that particular camera feed at the particular date and time when the incident took place to see if there's any evidence that may be useful in a criminal prosecution or an investigation. Face surveillance technology and other forms of what are called video analytics profoundly change the nature of those camera networks and basically create the conditions for mass surveillance of people's movements, associations, habits, and behaviors in public space. And so the way that the technology does that is by tracking our individual unique characteristics, our biometrics, including our faces. Law enforcement nationwide now have access to database systems, including at registries of motor vehicles. So when you go to get your driver's license or a state ID taken, or a state ID, your photograph is taken and your image is contained in a database next to your name and other identifying information. And increasingly across the United States, those records are available for law enforcement to use when they want to implement a facial recognition or a face surveillance program. So our ultimate concern here is that we need to make sure in the United States we do not allow law enforcement officials at the state or local or federal levels to construct systems of surveillance that are so pervasive that it would be relatively easy, in fact trivial, for a police officer to type in your name into a database and automatically get a record of every place you've been seen by a camera for however long the surveillance data is stored. So if a city stores surveillance data for 5 years, you type in Warren's name into the system, and the machine learning technology automatically stitches together a record of your movements and your associations, maybe pairing it with information from databases like Google, showing that you've been in the vicinity of an abortion clinic 6 times, that you've been in the vicinity of a sex shop 6 times, that you've visited a therapist every week at the same time for 5 years. This is the kind of pervasive surveillance state that face surveillance technology enables, and it is truly frightening and, frankly, repellent to a free society, and flies in the face of what it means to live in a democracy. So we're trying to stop it.
There have been concerns about surveillance of different kinds before this technology was developed. I know in Los Angeles, the police department for years maintained a political surveillance outfit, and they used to infiltrate groups, many of them peaceful protest groups, and records ultimately emerged showing that they were described as hotbeds of revolution and that sort of thing. So are there precedents for trying to control this kind of use of such information by law enforcement?
Absolutely. So, you know, we have a number of concerns about how a system like this could be used to violate the public's trust. Some of those concerns relate to personal misuse and abuse, right? I mean, law enforcement officials are human beings. They have daughters who are dating young men. They have wives who may be, having affairs. They have neighbors who may be complaining in the condo association, right? And repeatedly, all throughout the country, we've seen over the past 20 or so years that when you give law enforcement access to a surveillance system, whether it's the NSA's signals intelligence database that, you know, NSA analysts were shown to have used for inappropriate personal reasons, spying on their loved ones, etc., or it's state and local law enforcement misusing their access to criminal intelligence databases for personal reasons. Police officers can misuse and abuse their power for personal reasons. And what you've raised is a critical issue. We are extremely concerned that in the midst of an environment, a political environment, where there's a lot of protest, there's a lot of increased union activity across the country, young people are demanding with increasing vigor that we take action on climate. The Black Lives Matter movement is still alive and well across the United States. And the unfortunate legacy of law enforcement surveillance, sometimes infiltration, and even attempts to break up some of those left-wing protest movements is unfortunately not history. We have plenty of evidence. In fact, Defending Rights and Dissent, a sister organization of the ACLU, just last week put out a report about this very subject, showing that over the past 10 years, the FBI has worked hand in hand with state and local police all across the United States to monitor and disrupt effectively left-wing organizing. So yes, we are very concerned that a technology like face surveillance in the hands of state and local police and the federal government would essentially supercharge those political surveillance operations.
Some cities, including I think San Francisco, have banned the use of this material by the law enforcement agencies. What's been the reaction to them?
That's right. So the ACLU has been waging a coast-to-coast campaign from San Francisco to Somerville, Massachusetts, working with local officials and communities to ban the municipal government's use of this technology. So the first city, as you said, was San Francisco, followed quickly thereafter by Somerville, which is a bedroom community of Cambridge right here in Massachusetts. Then Oakland and Berkeley, California, followed quickly. We are also working in a number of communities besides Somerville in Massachusetts, Cambridge, Springfield, Brookline, among others, to pass municipal bans. And I think that these are really important pieces of local law. What we are seeing effectively is, especially in Silicon Valley, but also here in Massachusetts, where we actually have a more significant technology industry per capita than California's. We have more tech workers in Massachusetts per capita than any state in the nation, although we're obviously a much smaller state than California. The tech industry looms large here and is extremely important in our economy. I don't think it's an accident that we're seeing these tech industry dominant locations like Cambridge and Somerville and San Francisco and Oakland and Berkeley taking the first steps in the nation to ban the government's use of this technology. That's because the people who are making these tools, first of all, know that they are fallible, know that at present they don't work all that well, and second, are aware of the basic axiom that knowledge is power, right? And if you know everything about someone else, you can control their life. It's kind of what we saw with the Cambridge Analytica scandal on Facebook. If you know everything about every voter's interest, what makes them afraid, what makes them excited, you can target them with advertising that manipulates their fears and their hopes to get them to do what you want them to do, to vote for Donald Trump. And the same issues are at play here when we talk about face surveillance. If I know everything about you, I can control your life. And the people who get this the most are the people who work in the technology industry, because frankly, it's how they make a lot of money. And so I don't think it's a surprise at all that we're seeing these communities in particular take the first steps to prohibit the government's use of these tools. The fact that the people who are building these technologies do not want them used on themselves or their families in their communities, I think should send a very strong message to the rest of the nation that we ought to pump the brakes and make sure that our democratic values and, frankly, the people of the United States are in the driver's seat, making decisions about how, if at all, we want to integrate these types of surveillance technologies into our civic and political life. Because, you know, Jeff Bezos will tell you that the book has already been written, that because the technology exists, it will be deployed in every conceivable scenario. We at the ACLU believe in democracy. We believe in something quite different from that. We believe that it's up to us, actually, to decide whether or not we are going to implement Jeff Bezos's surveillance technologies in our communities, in our governments. And our position is that we ought not to. And so we are working as hard as we can to make sure that the future is a free one where we can have access to technologies but not be controlled by them.
Kate Crawford, again, director of the ACLU of Massachusetts Technology for Liberty Project. We'll come back to you as we continue our program. But first, I want to go exactly to one of the people that you are talking about. Eric Learned Miller is professor in the College of Information and Computer Sciences at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He is into this. Professor, great to have you with us.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Okay, so you are developing some of the video analytics and machine learning that Cade Crawford says has now overcome the problem of so many cameras that a lot of human beings simply can't look at and study all the time. Do you want this applied to you?
Well, first, let me start by saying I agree with virtually everything Cade said, and both factually and in spirit. So I don't want to ruin the ruin the fireworks for the show.
We don't need fireworks. We need information.
You know, I think the idea of putting on the brakes and taking a step back and saying, looking carefully at the harms and the benefits that could arise in different situations is something that's way overdue, and that these bans, while we're figuring that out, make a lot of sense. Now, having said that, you know, there's a lot of things you could do with face recognition technology. So I'm not an expert in surveillance, and I'm not an expert in privacy. But I've looked at many, many different applications of face recognition technology on the bad end. You know, the worst possible ones, in my opinion, would be things like automatic weapon systems that would kill people without any human input, which I just think is an awful idea. On the other hand, I wrote a paper in which we attempted to build an automatic screening mechanism for a disease. So imagine you're at the Department of Motor Vehicles, and when you're renewing your license, a questionnaire comes up and says, would you like your face to be screened for certain medical conditions? And you can opt in or opt out. And if you opt in, then it runs a program and says, you know, we believe that we did not detect any possible diseases, or we recommend that you see a physician potentially about this particular condition, which we have detected you may have, or you may want to talk to your doctor about it. For example, hyperthyroidism, there's another condition called acromegaly or Cushing's disease. So these diseases are all characterized by the fact that doctors often don't find them until they've been progressing for years and years. And a system like that could potentially bring patients to their doctors much sooner and save lives and improve health outcomes. So that's on the other end of the spectrum, where you have an opt-in system that could potentially help people lead better lives. So, and you know, there are examples up and down the spectrum. And the thing that I'm pushing right now really is to step back and try to delineate the risks of different kinds of applications and also the potential benefits. So the risks that Cade brought up are incredibly important. the ability of people to track you is a big negative. And unless we can come up with a way to rein that in or control it or provide guarantees to customers, then I'd say it's perfectly reasonable for a municipality or a government to say that's an application that we don't want to do. But then they don't necessarily have to ban all of face recognition, but ban certain applications that involve certain risks of violation of privacy, of unfairness, of false arrest, and all these other issues.
Let's just pause for a moment. Let me ask you this. You write the software for computers, but you say that understanding face recognition is a window into human intelligence and a way of determining how the brain works. Tell us more about that.
Right. I would say my primary interest is understanding human intelligence, and I've worked in neurology and neurosurgery for 7 years. I was a psychology major as an undergraduate, and I'm also a computer science professor, and I find that by trying to build things that are able to do some of the things people can do, whether it's recognize objects or walk through a forest as a robot or recognize faces, you tend to get a lot of insights into how these problems can be solved, and that can lead to understanding of general intelligent behavior. Face recognition is one of the more remarkable abilities of the human visual system. Faces have this property that they're all very similar in one sense. They have two eyes, a nose, and a mouth, for the most part, and yet we have the capacity to recognize thousands or even millions of different faces. If you want to see how much you're squeezing out of a face image, it's interesting to look at 100 pictures of faces and turn them all upside down. And when you turn them upside down, your brain is unable to discriminate as well between them. There's an enormous part of your brain called the fusiform gyrus that's dedicated to recognizing faces. And even if you just turn them upside down, even though you've got the same information there, your brain's no longer able to tell the difference between people who look superficially similar. So digging into how we have this amazing ability to tell the difference among thousands and thousands of different people who, in some sense, on the surface look quite similar, is a window into our ability to understand the visual world.
Okay, so everybody who's listening to this now is turning their cell phone upside down, if they're not driving, in order to try to check out what it is that you're suggesting. The question that arises, it seems to me, is how accurate are the identifications that are made both by human beings and by artificial intelligence? I understand some people are really good at it, some people are really bad at it, and as far as the artificial intelligence aspects are concerned, as was mentioned by Cade Crawford, in Greater London, something like 98% of the images turned out to be wrong.
Yes. Well, the number one most important thing to understand about the accuracy of these systems is that it completely depends upon the context. So just to give you a couple of examples, if I have five passport photos, which are taken in controlled lighting conditions, you know, people are asked to remove their glasses and remain expressionless, and I'm only trying to tell the difference among five people, that's a relatively easy problem. But if I'm looking at a surveillance camera that's low resolution and there's some shadows on the faces, perhaps the angles from above, and I'm comparing against 10,000 subjects, my accuracy is going to be atrocious, whether I'm a person or an algorithm. So there's no single number that characterizes accuracy. There's a spectrum of easy conditions and arbitrarily hard conditions that nobody could possibly get right. And so the important thing is to be able to say something about restrictions on the kinds of conditions you're going to accept. And back to the passport example, you know, you can't submit a passport example taken in poor lighting and things like that, because immigration officials want to have a clear picture of you. But unfortunately, there are many software products out there in which it's not made clear to the end user what those conditions need to be. And not only is it, even if they try to make it clear, I would argue these users need to be trained. They need to understand how to evaluate whether that's been done properly, and to throw out anything in which it hasn't been done properly. And that's all before you even start talking about privacy issues. That's just talking about how to use a system according to its intended use.
Eric Leonard Miller, once again, professor at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. We're going to continue this conversation in just a moment and go back to the phrase that I used at the beginning, the tension that's now existing between privacy and freedom, with a man who has written a book about that. We'll be back in a moment. This is To The Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, and I have stolen for the title of our program the subtitle of a book by David Brin. He's author of The Transparent Society: Will Technology Force Us to Choose Between Privacy and Freedom? He's a scientist, he's a tech consultant, he's also a science fiction writer, best known for The Postman. And David Brin, it's great to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Warren.
Are you concerned, as is Cade Crawford, to the extent that you think we ought to ban the use of this technology, at least until, as Eric Leonard Miller suggests, we can figure out how to limit it?
Well, those are two clauses in one sentence and one question, Warren, and the answer to the first part is absolutely yes. I'm totally concerned. Anybody who's been raised in Western civilization has been raised on generations of Hollywood propaganda of suspicion of authority, tolerance, diversity, and eccentricity. We were all raised by that. A Republican is worried that that academics and faceless government bureaucrats are trying to become Big Brother. A Democrat is worried that oligarchs and faceless corporations are trying to become Big Brother. And it's too bad we don't recognize this common theme that we're terrified, from a great science fiction novel, 1984, of Big Brother and oppression from the top and a return to 6,000 years of feudalism. We have a narrow oasis of freedom here, and it's grown across the last 200 years. It's kept growing, but it's always under threat. And we were terrified of it, and Cade made that fear extremely clear. And yes, the technologies can be used against us, as illustrated in 1984 by the telescreen, which Big Brother and the party use against the people. But then you go on, and it frustrates me. I urge everyone out there, by the way, I want it to be very clear that I probably vote exactly the same as Cade and Eric on major issues, and I share the same fears, and I want everyone to join the ACLU and especially the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They are active, and they are our paladins for freedom, and they're active in the right directions, and they have their tactics absolutely, diametrically, 100% wrong. They actually believe that you can bottle technology and that the solution to potential abuse by elites is to hide from them, to block their ability to see us. And across 6,000 years, they cannot point at a single example across all of human history of a time when that approach to getting freedom and privacy ever worked, even slightly. Elites will not let themselves be blinded. If we outlaw technologies, the elites of government, commerce, criminality, foreign elites, they will simply use these technologies in secret. As Robert Heinlein said, privacy laws that limit technology only make the bugs smaller. Now, I was in London when they were first rolling out these CCD cameras. It inspired me to write The Transparent Society. And I noticed that across the last 20 years, this is always the reflex of the decent people who are fearful about the decay of liberty. And across 200 years, it's something entirely different that got us our freedom. And that is surveillance. You answer surveillance with surveillance, S-O-U-S. It's French, like surveillance. It means looking back at power. And that's what we've done. That's how we got this narrow island of liberty. These technologies are not going to be blocked. Cade said the fact that elites don't want light on them means we should pump on the brakes. No, the fact that elites don't want the light to show on them means we must force the light on them. These are technologies that will not be stopped. In fact, even right now, the laws passed in San Francisco are obsolete. The facial recognition systems are entering into apps that are free mesh shared among users. You won't even need a database anymore. Let's distill it down to the fundamental, okay? What matters more? What elites know about you or what elites can do to you? And what matters above all, as Cade said, is what these elites can do to you. And hiding from them won't prevent them from doing anything to you. Stripping them naked will prevent them from doing things to you. We must focus our attentions on reciprocity, on reciprocal accountability, on being a brave citizenry who embraces this unstoppable tsunami of technology and uses it to enforce our own freedom.
I want to know how you intend to do that, but first, let me go back to Cade Crockford and tell us what's happening in China and the way that this technology is being used there.
Sure. Is it okay with you if I respond to some of the things that were just said?
Because, sure.
All right. The claim that essentially the people are powerless to alter the future of technology, or at least it sounded like that was what was just said, I think is completely wrong. And we have some recent history that I can talk about to illustrate how it's wrong. So take, for example, the CCTV cameras that I mentioned before that are all over the United States. There are millions of them everywhere. CCTV cameras only capture video, not audio. And that is not because the technology was not didn't exist in the 1960s and 70s when these cameras started to proliferate in, you know, banks and other parts of the United States. It is because in the 1960s, we passed wiretap statutes all over the United States. We passed laws that made it a crime, in many cases a serious crime, to record or transmit the content of someone's speech in some states without their permission, in some states without their knowledge. So that is why CCTV cameras only record video and not audio. The law changed the technology. We decided as a people, and in fact, it was an accidental victory in that sense. I don't think that the people who designed the wiretap statute, either at the federal level or in the states, contemplated that their decision to allow, in very limited circumstances, law enforcement officials to listen in on the private contents of our phone conversations would have the impact of changing an entire technology industry. But that's exactly what it did. Companies that manufactured CCTV cameras did not include microphones on those cameras because if they had, they wouldn't have been able to sell them in all 50 states. Banks, other companies that need CCTV cameras would have been sued by people who would have alleged under state and federal wiretap laws that the banks and whoever else is secretly audio recording people are in violation of those statutes. So that is a very clear and recent example of how the law actually does control technology in the United States. The problem that we have now is not that we couldn't get the technology under our control. And I also just want to be clear that the ACLU's position is not to ban facial recognition. Our position is to prohibit the government from using facial recognition technology, which is eminently possible. So, you know, we're not saying ban the technology outright. You know, nobody's allowed to use it in any context. You know, the NFL can't use it to more accurately or quickly or efficiently, come up with statistics from their games. We're not saying that. We're saying that the police can't use it, first of all. And second, the idea that we are powerless in the face of the technology's mere existence just simply does not comport with U.S. history, and also I think misses the point about how our society ought to function, which is that, again, we are in the driver's seat, not faceless corporations, not government agencies like the FBI, and we do have the power to make those decisions. And as Somerville and San Francisco have shown, we can make those decisions. The third point is that there's a profound information asymmetry that results from the government's use of this technology. You know, I think the reference to a society in which we are transparent and which we subject elites to scrutiny is a really important point. This technology makes that impossible, because the only entity that is going to have access to a networked surveillance camera system combined with the personally identifiable information in databases like driver's databases, like the State Department's passport database, is the government. Nobody else has access to that information. Maybe corporations like Facebook could match the government's reach in that capacity, but ordinary people, we can't. And so the idea that, you know, we could potentially use this technology to perform surveillance of the elite, I think is really fanciful. It requires access to technology and information that the vast majority of the public lacks, and is yet another reason why we ought to severely limit, if not prevent entirely, government in a free society from using this technology. You know, what's going on in China, I think, is a warning. It should be a warning for the people of the United States. The Chinese government is using this technology to great effect to control and oppress the minority Muslim Uyghur population in a province in China. And it just goes to show you that despite the technical flaws with the technology that currently exist, it is possible now to use these systems to keep track of where people go, who they go with, what they do, and when. And governments who choose to do that will be able to exert truly terrifying forms of control over the people they rule. So that's what we're trying to prevent here. And I think the idea that we are powerless in the face of a technologically determined future is not only unnecessarily pessimistic and dystopian, but it's also false. And recent history shows us that.
David Brin, what about it? Are we powerless? Is that what you meant to say?
Of course not. Absolutely diametrically opposite, as everything that Cade said. I believe that we can prevent the Chinese scenario by assertively and aggressively being citizens and taking control and being confident and not trying to do a chimeric and unbelievable notion that we can hide. The notion that Cade said, and by the way, again, I'm saying this with all friendliness because I'm glad she's out there in the fight. She's one of our paladins fighting against things that we both share. No, she doesn't believe that I share it, but I know that she shares my feelings that we need to fight very hard to prevent the Chinese future. What I'm saying is that governments and other elites will be able to hide these technologies if we ban them. And the only way we'll be able to detect it, if they are hiding these technologies or they're using these technologies illicitly, the only way we can get her solution is by using my solution first, and that is to strip the elites naked. Now, as she claims,
how do you do that? What do you mean, strip them naked?
Well, we do that in 2013. We had the best year for human rights in America in this century, and the news media didn't cover it because it was good news. And that was when the Obama administration and the courts, thanks in part to lawsuits by the ACLU, declared that we have a right to record our interactions with police. Nothing could be more important, because this is the part of the hierarchy of elite power that could hurt us personally and does minorities every day. And this resulted in a complete change of the narrative, so that now It's only skulking the worst cops who try to grab your cell phone, and often they're caught by some other cell phone across the street. And it's having major, not overnight, not black and white, but major effects immediately. This is called surveillance, and it's looking back. We got an example from the whistleblower end, the whistleblower in the Trump case, the Snowden and Assange and the Panama Papers and all of that. These are how you apply light upon the mighty, and it's what a confident people can do. And this is what the Chinese are desperate to prevent. They want, as Cade said, the asymmetry of light. And this has been the way it has been in every human civilization that was dominated by feudalism across 6,000 years, is the elites bent every effort to make sure that it's unidirectional. The problem is that Kay doesn't think that I'm optimistic about technology. She doesn't think I'm on her side, even though I made it extremely clear that we're arguing about tactics. There is simply no way that you are going to prevent the Moore's law of cameras from making them smaller, faster, better, cheaper, more mobile, and more numerous at a rate that exceeds Moore's law spectacularly, and drones and all of that. The only way we're going to keep track of these technologies and have our own answer to them as people is if we're in there and we're using them and we're telling the elites to strip. And we can tell them to strip through NGOs like the ACLU.
Let me go back to Eric Miller, who said we weren't going to have fireworks on this program. And let me ask you this. Is this technology available not just to elites, whether they're governments or corporations, but ultimately to everybody?
Well, I certainly agree with what was said about access to data. It's more likely that governments will have access to massive databases, felony databases, driver's license databases, and so on. So that asymmetry is out there for sure. And, you know, I honestly think both of these ideas, shining a light on things and also banning certain things or restricting certain technologies, they can both work. I think they for an alternative, you know, one of the classic things people are worried about is a police officer, arrests somebody uses a camera that they're carrying to match to a felony database, and maybe they arrest this person. The person believes they're innocent and resists arrest, and it escalates into a bad situation. And then later it turns out that the face recognizer was wrong, and so perhaps a person gets shot due to this error in face recognition. Well, one of the principles that we're trying to develop, and so I haven't mentioned this work yet, but I'm trying to develop a set of principles around that will help policymakers and regulators decide what kinds of technology are appropriate for deployment and what are not. There's something I call corroboration before action. So when the risk in the utility of a particular application is high, then you want to find a way to corroborate what's being corroborate the decision before you take action on it. So, for example, that would allow a forensic specialist to use face recognition technology if they can then back it up with human examination or other sources of evidence. But if they couldn't back it up, then they would have to throw it out. But it could still be useful. So, for example, one application, the FBI often examines photos in child sexual abuse cases to track down sex traffickers and things like that. And this technology has significantly helped them apprehend sex traffickers. So, and before they apprehend them, they are corroborating their recognition with other sources of evidence to minimize the impact. That doesn't mean that people can't abuse the technology, But we can, I do believe we can pass laws that say that certain kinds of technology should not be allowed because the risks are too high, but other kinds would be reasonable.
David Brin, you said that there's no way we can control this, that the Moore's Law applies, it's going to get better and better, and it's going to be more and more difficult to control it, and we simply have to let it go.
Well, we live in a world that would have been dismissed as science fiction just 10 years ago, 20 years ago. The things we're arguing about right now were science fiction 10 or 20 years ago. And I could name an endless list of highly plausible and highly probable technologies that we will have in 10 years that make this current debate just relegate it to quaintness. I am not saying that everything is technologically predetermined. But what I am saying is that it is a tsunami. And we are better off, instead of acting like King Canute, standing in the tide, aiming our hand out athwart history and yelling at the tide, at a tsunami, to stop. We're better off learning to surf.
Can I just make one specific recommendation? So one of the issues that's come up a couple of times in this conversation is the ability for somebody using face recognition technology to, say, track a person over weeks, months, years, and look at their political activity and understand all kinds of vulnerabilities they have and manipulate them and so forth. So what's to keep us from passing a law that says, you have 1 minute to make a determination of who somebody is, after you've taken the photo, and then the photo by law has to be destroyed, and that if you determine you have more than one photo of this person from the last year, it also has to be destroyed. I mean, I'm just making this up at the spur of the moment, but what's to keep us from putting legal limitations? Now, you can always argue people won't pay attention to the law, but that's a different argument. What's to keep us from putting legal limitations on technology that keep the government from doing the precise things that are the source of the problem?
Can I just jump in, since I'm the person who does law reform work in the conversation? I think that's a really important point. Yeah, that's a really important point, Eric. And a couple things about this idea that we are powerless against the tsunami of technology. First of all, it is certainly the ACLU's view that we ought to watch the state and, what you're calling the elite. We have fought to expand access to public records across the United States. As you said, it was our First Circuit federal litigation that ruled in Massachusetts and throughout New England and Puerto Rico, you have a right to film the cops. We are currently engaged in litigation arguing that you even have a right to film the cops in secret because, police will sometimes act violently if they see that you're holding your phone out. So you actually have a right in order to express your First Amendment right to film the police. Sometimes you need to do it secretly. We love watching the state. I'm not making a case to say we should not watch the state. We should merely ensure the state can't watch us. But both of those are necessary. You can't have a situation in which, again, the government has access to all of these databases and cameras and can track us all. There are no laws preventing that. And our only tool to fight back against that is public records requests. That's simply not a good situation for us to be in. And the second thing I want to say is that sort of like what Eric just said, it seems like part of your argument is that, no matter what law we pass, people will just violate it. And that doesn't seem to me to be a very serious argument. People do break the law, of course, but that's not an argument against having laws. The law is one of the most powerful ways that we shape not only human action, but also technology, as I demonstrated with the example of CCTV cameras and the wiretap law. So, is it possible that if we pass laws preventing law enforcement from conducting face surveillance in the United States, some police departments will do it anyway? Absolutely. Police break the law all the time. That is not an argument against passing a law to prohibit them from doing it. It also provides procedural protections because of something called the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine,
For criminal defendants. If you are identified in a criminal investigation or tracked using technology that is illegal, the police are not going to be able to use that information to convict you and send you to jail. So, you know, the idea that because cameras get smaller and the technology gets cheaper, it's meaningless or fruitless to try to pass laws that restrict the government's ability to use these technical systems, I just don't see that that's really relevant to the conversation at all.
David Brin, you said that the laws already in San Francisco are obsolete. Are you suggesting that the technology just gets ahead of the law and you can't keep up?
Well, yes, I'm saying that. But first of all, let me compliment Cade. She has been very, very agile and responding to my points. And I appreciate the previous one, fruit of the poisonous tree and all of that. Nevertheless, Warren, as you say, these technologies simply aren't grasped by the people taking this approach. All the streetlights are going to be part of the Internet of Things soon. The notion that there's no sound pickups in these cameras out there is utterly obsolete.
What do you mean it's obsolete? Is it against the law, though?
Well, yes, it's against the law. But the point is, here is the fundamental point. You want to make temporary, because they will be temporary, laws against this or that kind of information flowing upward to elites. Knock yourself out. I'm fine with that. And there have been some that have been very useful, but they can only be effective in the context of surveillance, in the context of where we are enforcing our ability to supervise government and supervise the elites of commerce and, yes, criminality, et cetera.
Well, on that point, we have 100% agreement, just so you know. I mean, we obviously believe that accountability and transparency are fundamental to ensuring that the government fulfills its legal obligations, 1,000%.
And that's why I it irritates me no end whenever I have these debates with my dear friends who I adore and who are fighting for us, like Cade and the ACLU and the EFF, and I always urge people to join them. We're arguing as friends about a misapplication of tactical resources. They spend 90% of their energies on trying to hold back a technological tsunami and 10% on the supervision side. And I'm saying that the 90% should be spent on stripping the elites naked, because it's historically what has worked. And the delaying actions on some of, sure, pass these laws, but they are delaying actions.
Eric Leonard Miller, I just want to ask you one more question, and that is, what are the prospects for all of us to start spying on each other because we are able to lock in to various surveillance systems and databases so that you can find out an awful lot about your neighbor? Is there any control on that?
I mean, you can buy infrared cameras and spy cams on the web for a small amount of money, and you can set up very small cameras to look at people in various places. I think that's only going to get worse. But let's see, I want to make a point about transparency. I mean, one of the things that I'm trying to do is help the public understand and help the public and policymakers understand the details of technology, the details that are important, like what are the risks and possible benefits to privacy, to fairness, to inaccuracy and false positives and false negatives, to allow people to understand the implications of the technology, allow everybody to understand it, the government, the citizens, the users, and so forth, so that good policy can be written. So that's what I see as my role. I think all these issues are important, and I'm trying to be a conduit from the technology to help people understand the implications of the technology.
All right. Well, let me just say this is the beginning of a conversation that I think we're going to be hearing about for a long, long time. And you've all defined the various issues and options that we have right now supremely well. And I want to thank you for it. Again, Eric Learned Miller is a writer of facial recognition software at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Amherst. David Brin is a scientist, a tech consultant, a science fiction writer, The Postman, one of his books, the other, The Transparent Society, Will Technology Force Us to Choose Between Privacy and Freedom? Cade Crockford, the director of the ACLU of Massachusetts Technology for Liberty Project, very involved in those issues, as we heard. Thank you all very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Terrific, Warren.
Today's podcast was produced by Andrea Brody with audio assistance from P.J. Shahamat. Our engineer is Chuck Previtary. You can find all of our previous episodes on your favorite podcasting app. And do this. Contact us directly on social media. You can tweet us at tothepoint_KCRW. I'm at WarrenAlney1. We want to know what you think and what you'd like to hear. Thanks for being with us this time. Come back again.